Everybody, welcome to Two at the First. It is June the 19th, 2023. I'm Brian Balogi. Great to have you here with us. It's a voice-only show today, just because a lot of crazy things going on. Just came back from vacation. Obviously, the U.S. Open was nuts. Wanted to talk about that with you for a little while. Do a show on Tuesday to kind of go over some more maybe intricate parts of things and get ready for the week ahead, including the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, as well as the Travelers Championship. We are presented by our friends at Swannies. If you want to check them out, swannies.co. That's swannies.co. Check them out. They're wonderful. They have great, tremendous apparel. Doesn't cost you a ton of money. Looks great. Feels great. Wore a ton of it on vacation, including their wonderful hoodies that have become a common staple in my wardrobe. So swannies.co for all things Swannies. Okay. Let's talk about the U.S. Open. Wyndham Clark wins his first major championship, holds his nerve, wins on 10 under par, 270, and beats Rory McIlroy by a shot. In the end, for McIlroy, it was probably the performance in the par fives that cost him, particularly on Sunday. He gets home practically in two on eight, setting up what should have been a birdie opportunity, boots a four and a half footer for birdie there after a couple of holes earlier, nearly booting a four footer for par. Four-three-footer even, for par, but probably got in his head a little bit. And then you get to 14. He tries to play smart golf, which really is a mistake for McIlroy. He shouldn't play smart golf. He should play his brand of golf. But he tried to play smart, lays up to a good number, which he probably shouldn't have done. The analytics tell us he probably shouldn't have done that. Probably should have just tried to get closer and found a way up and down from there. But nevertheless, tries to play smart. Misses the green inexplicably from 125 yards. Fortunately, the ball plugs because it got him a decent drop, free relief from an embedded lie. But he was unable to get up and down. It was his only bogey and put himself in a position so far back that unless Clark made some serious mistakes and effectively just choked the thing away, that McIlroy was not going to win. And to his credit, Clark didn't do that. He played really well. He played like a guy who was trying to win a first major, played like a guy who was a little bit nervous. He made some mistakes, made some bad swings, put himself in some not so great spots, less than optimal spots off the tee. But the thing that he did on Sunday, and frankly, the thing that he did best all week, was to know time and score, know what the shot and situation required. And then the most important part, he executed it. Time and again, over the course of the weekend, he found himself in a situation where I think most people who are rooting for McIlroy or Scheffler or someone else other than him, Fowler, they thought he was going to choke right then and there. And that was going to be the beginning of the end, the demise. I mean, even Paul Azinger did it a few times, particularly on the ninth hole, which is something I'm not going to forget anytime soon, where to Wyndham's credit, he played a really smart shot from back of the target to the left of it, playing to the crest of a hill, hoping that that would give him the best chance to trickle down toward the hole and make his par. And not once, not twice, maybe even three times, but Azinger said, oh, the ball's not coming back. Oh, it's not coming back. Oh, it's not going to come back. And then it got to 6 feet. He made the up and down. And I think that is exactly emblematic of what happened in this U.S. Open, where it seemed like people figured he was going to choke or break or fail or not do the right thing. And time and again, he did. The second shot into 14 was aggressive. He got home. He knew he had a small landing area, but he pulled it off. And that's going to, I think, be the shot that I think most people are going to remember in the end when they put together the highlight film and all that stuff, that they try to look back on what was the most important part of the week. That shot where he goes to his knees and kind of begs for it to hit the green, that was the one. That was the winner. And yes, he bogeyed the par three. It was, what, 130? And he was the only guy who bogeyed it that day in the final round. But he had built up enough of a cushion, and he had assured himself enough times that if he just made one mistake, if it was a one-stroke mistake, right, a bogey, then he was going to be okay because he could save par, he could make birdie, he could recover from a bogey, but he wasn't going to recover from double bogeys, and that's what happens in majors. The players that often fail to get the job done are the ones that make the big mistake, or they just never get started in the first place, which is kind of what happened to Scottie Scheffler and Ricky Fowler, and Cam Smith made a nice run on Sunday. He moved up the board. Xander Schauffele. Rory McIlroy didn't make a lot of mistakes. I mean, he had the one bogey, but he didn't take enough advantage of his length, of his amazing driving over the course of the week, that the thing that really put him into this position. And the wedge play is still bad. I mean, it is bad. And certainly for a player of his character and caliber that gets into this position often enough, that finds himself there frequently, that you would think after being a public golfer for 15 or 16 years, a guy who's been a legitimate major championship contender for almost 15 years, really 13, that he would figure out a way to be better as a wedge player, that he would do something radically different just to try to figure it out, to be better. And he can't. He doesn't. He is who he is. And that is why he has found a 9-year gap now between major championship wins. The good news for McIlroy is that we go to a venue in a month's time where he won his one and only Open Championship at Royal Liverpool, at Hoylake, whatever you want to call it. And the good news for Ricky Fowler, who we haven't talked about yet, we'll talk about him in a little bit, is he was T2 in that Open Championship, and he seems to have found confidence and belief, and that might have been a fragile amount of it, because I think what happened on 16 in the third round, where he missed the birdie to get to 12 under, that would have given him, I think at the time, a 3-shot lead. I think that was the turning point for him. Once he missed that, I think the confidence went away. He booted the par putt on 18 in the third round. That got him into a tie, or dropped him into a tie with Wyndham Clark, who had just come off one of the highest points of the tournament for him, or for anybody for that matter, and found himself in the final group. And I think that carried over, unfortunately, for Fowler. But he has come a long way from a guy that was almost 200th in the world when he made that phone call to Butch Harmon in the fall, and has gotten himself back comfortably in the top 40 in the world. Really strong player right now who just needs to kind of figure some things out to be a little bit better and maybe has a chance to contend at the Open in a few weeks. But again, we'll see what happens with weather and all that stuff. And so many things can happen in 3 or 4 weeks that you just never know for sure, right? And Scottie Scheffler, we have to have a couple words about him. Once again, Scottie Scheffler finishes in the top 3 of a golf tournament and looks like he is putting with a bladed wedge. I mean, it probably would be better with one in his hand at this point. He just cannot make anything. And yet still, he is an incredible ball striker. He puts himself close to the hole, relatively speaking, again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And it's really, really impressive. And he's going to get it. He's going to figure out to be a slightly better putter. And that's going to win him a whole lot of tournaments eventually. That might be the next major, right? Could come along then. I think that the thing that Scheffler obviously could take from this is that he's so good from tee to green that he can barely make anything longer than 7 feet, and he finished 3rd in the U.S. Open. He once again has posted a top 10 finish in a major championship. I mean, it's a ridiculous number of top 10 finishes in the last 20 majors for Scottie Scheffler. He is that good. Eventually, you would think he's going to figure it out just slightly better, and that's the thing to take away from Wyndham Clark. Wyndham Clark has become a dramatically better approach player this year on the main, you know, in the main. He wasn't the best at LACC. He was 43rd, I believe, in strokes gained on the approach. But that was good enough. That's better than 60th. And those are the kinds of margins that you need to be better than you were and to be a major champion. And McIlroy alluded to those. He said, hey, the margins out here are very thin. They're very small. And they are. So if you get slightly better, if you're McIlroy as a wedge player, you probably win more frequently. If you get slightly better as a putter, and I don't mean like 100 places better in strokes gained putting if you're Scottie Scheffler, but if you're just like 70th in strokes gained putting, you've probably won 5 tournaments this year already. And you already won a couple. So, I mean, the guy knows how to win. He knows what he's trying to accomplish. He's just not there yet. So once that lines up for him, and you assume it's coming because he is that talented of a player, it just feels like I keep saying this, but he's never going to lose again until he forgets how to putt. It's a remarkable thing to watch. Some other guys to point out, Xander Schauffele, we did point him out, fell apart on Sunday, really, but a nice week. Patrick Cantlay had a nice week, a guy that's going to be a horse for course name. A lot of people are probably going to think about, but I wouldn't necessarily bet to win at the Travelers Championship. Kudos to Colin Morikawa, who almost got into the top 10. Had a really nice week for himself. Two LIV guys played well. You had Cameron Smith, who finished fourth in a major. I told a lot of people not to sleep on him. Came up short, but he had the winning score for the last three U.S. Opens at 6 under total. So if you kind of thought about it in that context, he did what it took to win, just wasn't good enough to win. Dustin Johnson had a nice week. He seems to be kind of on the upswing. It was interesting to me that a number of players that you probably thought would be contenders, like Victor Hovland, Brooks Koepka, defending champion Matt Fitzpatrick, all eventually said later in the week that they didn't like the golf course, that there was something they didn't like about it. And it would have been really helpful if you were putting your hard-earned U.S. dollars or any kind of dollars on them to bet on them if you knew that ahead of time. Of course, they're not obligated to tell you that. They're never obligated to tell you anything. But it would have been helpful to know that you didn't like the layout. And I think that makes sense given Koepka really seems to thrive on courses that kind of punish you severely when you make mistakes. This one didn't do that. And so that makes sense to him. I wasn't sure Victor Hovland would like it, but he had been playing so well in the majors, and he still played pretty well. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't, but not as well as he did in the prior three. So there's something to be said for liking the course, right? If you just don't like what you see, you're fighting it the entire time, and it's really hard, I think, for these players, most players, I mean, it's not just these guys, not this era, to embrace a place you just don't really like. And it's hard to thrive in that environment where you're like, not again, not this shot. Oh, I hate this shot. Everything, you know, maybe you don't like the aesthetic, but it was a great leaderboard. I mean, the venue did a good job. You may not like the 10 under one, and I can understand that. But if you look at day one, the lead was set at 8 under 62, something that's never happened in the U.S. Open in 122 playings up until this 123rd one. And from that, the lead moved 2 strokes deeper under par. Now, typically in a U.S. Open, the first day lead is about as deep as it gets, and then it starts to kind of claw back toward par. That obviously didn't happen here. Got a little bit deeper because the second round was also not particularly difficult scoring-wise, but I thought the third and fourth rounds really held up very well, and that was, I think, a positive sign for the venue that it could do it, that it could challenge par if you had more sun, if it were drier at the start, if you kind of let it bake out a little bit more slowly over 4 days or maybe even over 7 days leading into it, as opposed to trying to kind of keep it in some kind of particular shape that they left it soft and susceptible for the first 2 days until they got sun, even the hint of wind, and maybe not as much marine layer, which if you were drinking every time you heard marine layer, I'm sorry for your liver. Yeah, that was probably a tough scene on the commentary side of things, but that's kind of the recap of at least the action and the course. And I think it deserves to have a conversation about Los Angeles Country Club, the USGA's involvement with the club, what they're going to experience coming back in 2039, and some of the mistakes that were probably made here this time around that I think took away from the overall feeling about the national championship. All right, before we get to that, I want to tell you about our friends at Club Choice Ireland. We are just 71 days out from heading to Ireland for an incredible trip that myself and my good buddy and GNN radio contributor Brendan Sweeney are going to have over there. It's going to culminate in us covering the Irish Open, which is going to be so, so cool. I've been over to Ireland, went over just before my wife and I had kids. It was an incredible experience. I mean, we saw Dublin. We took the train pretty much everywhere from Dublin and saw almost all of the major sites. We went up into Northern Ireland. Had a great time in Belfast, got to see actually one of the areas where my son's name comes from, the Carrickaree Rope Bridge, right near the Giant's Causeway. The people are amazing. The food is really good. That Coke's a little bit warm, but that's okay. But if you want to take a golf trip to Ireland, go to clubchoiceireland.com. You can find out about their tours. They can tailor golf tours to you. You can do a bigger group thing that they manage. Whatever you'd like to do, they can help you experience golf in Ireland, which is something I have never experienced. I didn't play golf when I went over with my wife now 10, you know, more than 10 years ago. So I'm so excited to be able to bring the clubs and to be able to bring to you guys through our social media channels what we're going to be doing, where we're playing with video, a little bit of audio, of course, for GNN Radio. Also, a lot of photography on Golf News Net's social channels as well, and mine personally. We're going to have such a great time. We're going to tell you all about it. But in the meantime, go to clubchoiceireland.com. Check out their packages that are available. Start thinking about 2024 and even, frankly, about 2025. And get connected to them and start thinking about your trip today. That's clubchoiceireland.com. Second part of the show, I want to talk about Los Angeles Country Club as a host venue. Not necessarily as a golf course. I really enjoyed the golf course. I thought Six was great. It was very interesting. Something unique in major championship golf. A kind of short par four where you have three real legitimate choices in how you want to play it. And all could be successful. And the scoring difference between them was not minuscule, but it was enough to suggest that you could play any way or you could play none of the ways. And depending on your style and your comfort level and your skill set, you played it one way or the other. And you had ways to be successful with each. Then you had the long par threes that were effectively the short par fours. They just slapped a par three on them instead of a par four. Those were interesting holes. And they were varied enough. Even though you were fundamentally just finding a way to hit 2-iron, 3-iron, 5-wood, whatever, just short of the green. And hit on with one of them. And then the more downhill, you're trying to just hit the green, but you still had to land that one short because of how hot you were coming in from the downhill. And it really made for interesting golf. And yes, I think that was kind of a strange thing that you had to knock those two holes down by basically one to make it be a par 70. So it wasn't really a par 70. It was more like a par 68. If we're thinking about it in modern terms of the game, and if you do think about it that way, well, then all of a sudden, obviously, you think about the winning score differently. Winning score was 2 under relative to the real par for the golf course. But I really liked the golf course itself. I thought the architecture was fun. I liked what Gil Hance did. It presented some interesting choices. Also, some just straight-up beast holes that you just had to put the ball in play and you had to hit the green. And that's what I think a U.S. Open is about. Not necessarily the winning score, but just really difficult demands of players. And a number of players said that they thought the golf course was fantastic. It was very difficult. It was not as easy as the scores relative to par might have indicated. But I feel like there was unanimous or as close to unanimous as you're going to get sentiment that something was missing from this U.S. Open. That the vibe was different Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday, really, but less so on Sunday, I suppose. And, of course, I don't think a lot of people knew why, because it wasn't talked about. It wasn't really talked about on TV. If you're a super golf geek like us, you probably knew because you saw somebody tweet about the ticket allotment and who was there and why, but if you haven't heard about this, I think it's worth explaining. So, the USGA has to come to an agreement with every host club who hosts the U.S. Open. Now, how many people can come, what that all looks like, sort of more or less where grandstands go, how people flow in and out of the venue, parking gets arranged by the USGA, all that stuff kind of gets worked out. But the host venue has a pretty significant say in how many people actually arrive at the venue each day. And for whatever reason, it's because the Los Angeles Country Club people want their club as private as possible. They wanted a U.S. Open without having 50,000 people a day there. And they could have had 50,000 people a day there. They could have had at least 30, 35 at a minimum. But they negotiated it down to just 23,000 people a day. Basically nothing. I mean, 23,000 people a day is very small in terms of a golf crowd spread out over 18 holes, much less at a venue that has multiple courses. So they have 23,000 people a day. A little bit more than half of those, actually significantly more than half, like 60% of those people, those tickets, went to corporate hospitality. So that was the point of this event. They decided to make up for the lack of people, the USGA did, by having more of them be high-priced corporate folks. who were there to entertain clients or be entertained, drink free booze, not really necessarily watch the golf. I mean, they might have been there for that, but they were there to be entertained in air-conditioned, nice chalets and tents. And so they really didn't kind of spend as much time on the golf course as a normal person would, a hardcore golf fan that would appear. Then the rest of the tickets were for the public, so to speak. However, Los Angeles Country Club and their membership and their related guests and friends got about half of those tickets every day. They either bought them up and sat on them, or they just bought them up and used them as they wanted, whatever. So that meant 4,000 to 5,000 people a day were rolling through the gates, and those were the general admission people. Those were the people that are like the golf hardcore. They're the people who make the noise and hoot and holler and get crazy a little bit and really define a golf tournament. Not just the US Open, that could be the Phoenix Open, that could be the Travelers Championship, whatever it is. That's what they do. That's who they are. They are the heartbeat of golf at a professional viewership level. And there were so few of them. I mean, effectively, and I'm not, this is not meant to be a slam on LIV, but this, it was like the size of a LIV crowd in terms of general admission. I mean, slightly less. Maybe you got 6,000 to 7,000 people a day for most LIV events. That's effectively what you had as the general admission population for the tournament. And that's just bad. I mean, it's bad for atmosphere. It's bad for noise. It's bad for television. You don't see people 2, 3, 4, 5 deep on the fairways. You just see a lot of people in grandstands and chalets, kind of hear a constant murmur, but there's not much of one because there are large stretches of the golf course where there were very few people watching golf, including down the stretch. It felt like a number of holes in the back where there was like nobody there, and it was not good watching. It created a sense that there weren't many people there because there weren't, and that they weren't interested in the championship. And I think the USGA giving into that demand, and it was almost certainly a demand made by Los Angeles Country Club to have fewer people there, ultimately hurt the vibe for the championship. Now, Sunday was better because everyone knew what was on the line, and I think people get more excited as you get to the end of the tournament, just naturally, right? However, the way that 18 was set up, because of 9's and 18's interaction and architecture, you couldn't have people just like right on top with massive grandstands and tons of people there to cheer and hoot and holler. And it just created a bit of a strange atmosphere for a national championship. And I think that's going to be remedied next year, obviously, with Pinehurst number 2 hosting. They've done a good job setting up grandstands to the left of 18. You've got people just kind of behind the green, good crowds there. Typically people with VIP type access, but they'll be there to watch it because that's what it is. I mean, that's what an Open is. But I that made me disappointed in Los Angeles Country Club, that they were willing to have the U.S. Open, but they weren't willing to have the real U.S. They were willing to have the tournament, but not the people. And that ultimately created a championship where I think people watching on TV were like, what is going on here? Why is no one cheering? Why is there nothing crazy happening? Why are there no rowdy people? And yes, it was nice to hear few people, if any, yelling, you know, mashed potatoes and light the candle and stuff like that. But I can't believe I'm saying this. I'd rather have that than have felt like utter silence and a lack of people at different points in the venue. So if that's what they were going for, you got me. I do not subscribe to the conspiracy theory that some people do, that the USGA set up the golf course so people could score so that they can make an argument to roll back the golf ball. I don't think that that's the conspiracy theory you want to subscribe to, if any. But what they did in terms of the economics of this to try to make it work for them, because they knew they couldn't get the club to agree to have tons of people there, created an unfortunate spot for them, created an unfortunate situation. That said, I thought they did a good job setting up the golf course. I think they presented it well as a golf test. I think they will tighten things up again. Once we get to 2039, this place is going to host it again in 2039. Golf's going to be a lot different. Golf's going to be more powerful, but it's also probably going to have an equipment rollback. We'll see what the impact of that is, and we'll probably have a better sense of that closer to the early 2030s. And so once we come back here at the end of the next decade, which is really crazy to think about that they've planned this thing out into as far as 2051. I mean, that's 28 years from now. I'll be 68. I love this job, but I hope I'm not talking about golf in 2051. I hope I am still able to play golf and maybe enjoy golf in some fashion, but not in this job. It's crazy to think about that, but the game is going to be a lot different. The course will probably be different. There will be some changes, but there's a lot to think about in 16 years. And that probably will not catch anyone's mind too substantially until, you know, at least 7 years from now, if not 15 years from now. So kudos as a venue, as a course, bad as a place for people and an atmosphere. And hopefully they've kind of fixed those things that were less than ideal about both before we get there in 2039. This week on the PGA Tour, we have the Travelers Championship designated event, TPC River Highlands, 40 of the world, top 50 in the field. We have another major. We have the KPMG Women's PGA Championship at Baltus Rawls Lower Course. Another Gil Hance special. He did a great job there. Played there a couple years ago when it reopened. I think you're going to love it. You may think of Baltus Rawls Lower as kind of a bland, boring, just really nice country club. But Hance did a really nice job enhancing a place, the pun intended, perhaps. It's going to be a great, great test. And then we've got the BMW International Open on the DP World Tour in Germany. Should be a fun week there. We'll be back with another show tomorrow. We'll have voice and video for you. If you listen to our show as a podcast and you do that on a podcast platform, let you do so. Please leave us a 5-star review. Helps us reach more people. If you have questions for me, you can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or shoot me a DM. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Ryan Ballingy. Follow Golf News Net on any of your favorite social media services at the handle Golf News Net. Check us out on Golf News Net Radio on iHeart and TuneIn. We've made it our best month ever so far, and we still have, 10 days left in this month. So thank you for that and your support. We'll be back with another show on Tuesday. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Two Off the First.